AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. This is the show where we take on careers that aren't just, you know, fast. They're genuinely chaotic. We try to map the landscape of genius, madness, and just pure, unrestrained output.
Yeah.
And today, we are immersing ourselves in the life and legacy of an actor who is, arguably, the most unpredictable figure in modern cinema, Nicolas Cage.
A map. I mean, it's more of a fractal diagram, honestly.
Right.
Yeah, because we're talking about an actor who's defined himself by extremes. Extreme versatility, this massive cult adoration, and a staggering financial footprint. To put that in context for you right away, his films have grossed over $6.4 billion worldwide.
Wow.
So to start this dive, you have to just acknowledge the contradictions.
Yeah.
He is an Oscar winner, a critically derided mega actor, a financial disaster, and now a celebrated cultural icon all at once. It's all happening at the same time.
And charting those contradictions is exactly our mission today. Please. This isn't just us reading through a filmography. We're going deep into the source material that covers his whole multifaceted life. Mm. From his early roots in, like, Hollywood royalty, the creation of his bizarre artistic philosophy, Nouveau Shamanic, right through to the dramatic tax disasters that forced him onto that notorious direct-to-video circuit. And then, finally, his triumphant critical comeback.
And that journey, it really begins fittingly with an act of radical self-creation. The person we know as Nicolas Cage was born Nicolas Kim Coppola.
Right.
It is absolutely impossible to discuss his career without first understanding the scale of the family name he chose to abandon.
Okay, so let's unpack the weight of that name.
Yeah.
When you hear Coppola, you're not talking about just, you know, simple show business success. You are talking about one of American cinema's few true royal houses.
Precisely. His father was August Coppola, a literature professor, and his mother was Joy Vogelsang, a dancer and choreographer. But the famous connections, they run deep. His uncle is the legendary director Francis Ford Coppola.
Of course.
And his aunt is the acclaimed actress Talia Shire, you know, from The Godfather and Rocky. That makes him first cousins with Sofia Coppola and Roman Coppola.
That is an immense legacy to walk into. The name carried immediate cultural capital, but also, I'd imagine, an immediate suffocating shadow, especially for a young guy starting out in the early 80s.
Exactly. And the source material makes it clear he felt that shadow immediately. He realized very early on, I think it was during the filming of Fast Times at Ridgemont High in 82, that his name was a massive problem for his own identity.
How so?
He says that other cast members, sensing the connection, would just constantly quote his uncle's films at him on set. Lines from Apocalypse Now, The Godfather. Wanted to be his own man.
So he wanted to stand entirely on his own merit. He wanted to, you know, dismantle that perception before his career even truly began. It's an act of self-purging.
It is. And the choice of the new stage name, Nicolas Cage, is, well, it's a perfect early sign of the wild, high-low eccentricity that would define him later on.
Where did it come from?
It is the ultimate fusion of the avant-garde and the populist. His inspiration came from two completely disparate figures, which really symbolizes the split in his artistic DNA.
Okay.
On the one hand, the experimental, groundbreaking composer John Cage.
High art.
Right. And on the other, the Marvel Comics superhero Luke Cage, the bulletproof hero for hire. Street-level integrity.
So you have high art and experimental sound mixed with pulp culture and working-class heroism. He fused those identities to create Nicolas Cage long before anyone in Hollywood was thinking about self-branding in that intentional, almost philosophical way.
He was building his own mythology right out of the gate.
Yeah, it shows a powerful, almost aggressive dedication to being seen as his own individual force.
And that identity forged so early on was initially fueled by a singular, passionate obsession that drove him toward acting in the first place. James Dean.
It's the classic origin story, isn't it? A teenager sees a performance that just completely changes the trajectory of his life.
That's precisely it. Cage explicitly said he wanted to be James Dean. He cites Dean's performances in East of Eden and Rebel Without a Cause as formative. He said nothing, not rock music, not classical music, affected him the way Dean did in East of Eden.
Just a lightning bolt moment.
An explosive, mind-blowing revelation that prompted the realization, that's what I want to do. He internalized that intensity and emotional vulnerability as his starting point.
And he didn't just quietly dream about it. The sources give us this wonderful anecdote about his ambition, trying to use the family connection before he formally ditched the name.
Oh, yeah.
At age 15, he tried to strong-arm his uncle, Francis Ford Coppola, into giving him a screen test.
You have to picture the scene. This 15-year-old, just full of that James Dean angst, is demanding validation from a director who had already won multiple Oscars and basically defined a generation of filmmaking.
What did he say?
Cage reportedly told his uncle, "I'll show you acting." The response, according to Cage, was just silence in the car.
Wow. A perfectly directed, minimalist response to just maximalist teenage hubris.
I think that moment, the silence in the car, was probably when he realized he absolutely had to forge his own path.
But he did pursue formal training. He went to the famed Beverly Hills High School, a notorious talent factory, and studied at the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television. So he grounded that passion in technique.
The initial professional steps were a little rocky. His debut was actually in a television pilot in 1981 called The Best of Times, which never got picked up by ABC.
Right.
His official film debut, as we mentioned, was that minor role in Fast Times at Ridgemont High in 82. He played an unnamed co-worker, and that's where the name change conversation became unavoidable because of all the Coppola quotes from his peers.
And he didn't even get the part he wanted, right?
No, interestingly, he originally auditioned for the much larger role that eventually went to Judge Reinhold.
But the starring roles came pretty quickly once he had shed the name. It wasn't long until he landed his first lead in the 1983 romantic comedy Valley Girl.
Valley Girl is such a fascinating early artifact. It was a low-budget film, but the plot was a clever, modernized riff on Romeo and Juliet.
The punk from Hollywood and the girl from the Valley.
Exactly. Cage played Randy, the Hollywood punk, who falls for the titular Valley Girl, played by Deborah Foreman. It was a modest box office success, but its cultural impact was enormous. It's now seen as a seminal cult classic.
It really captured that clash between 1980s punk rock authenticity and the whole burgeoning mall culture.
That balance of high concept and low budget charm really defined his first phase.
And it's so notable that despite the name change, he couldn't completely escape the Coppola orbit just yet.
Not at all. He had lost out on a major role, Dallas Winston to Matt Dillon in his uncle's 1983 adaptation of S. Hinton's The Outsiders.
Right.
But in that same year, he co-starred in Coppola's next adaptation of another Hinton novel, Rumblefish.
So even with the new name, he's still in the family business, so to speak.
Yeah.
It demonstrates how hard it is to fully escape those roots, but it also allowed him to work on serious dramatic projects even while he was finding his commercial footing in films like Valley Girl. And this early phase, it really sets the foundation for his intense dedication to character no matter the box office.
The commitment he showed for the 1984 drama Birdie is, frankly, astounding.
Mm-hmm.
It sets a precedent for the extremes he would take later in his life, both artistically and personally.
It's truly legendary. For Birdie, directed by Alan Parker, Cage was playing a Vietnam veteran who was left physically disfigured.
Right.
To achieve maximum authenticity, Cage dramatically lost weight for the role, and he actually had two of his front teeth pulled out without anesthesia to ensure he appeared genuinely broken and disfigured.
He had his teeth pulled. Oh. Without anesthesia.
Yes. This speaks volumes about the level of physical sacrifice he demanded of himself, even for a film that commercially underperformed.
To voluntarily undergo that kind of painful, permanent physical change for a role in a non-blockbuster film it's a massive statement about his artistic values. It's a level of method commitment that goes way beyond standard preparation.
And critics, despite the film's low box office numbers, absolutely noticed. Janet Maslin of the New York Times praised him, noting that he very sympathetically captures Al's urgency and frustration.
So even if the money wasn't there, the critical respect was.
Exactly. It established his bona fides as a dramatic actor willing to suffer for his art.
And he continued his ascent rapidly, showing this complete command of tone. In 1987, he starred in the Coen brothers' Raising Arizona as H.I. McDonough, the dim-witted, philosophical ex-con who just wants to raise a family.
That was a pivotal role. It showed he could channel that chaotic energy into a tight, comedic performance under the direction of masters like the Coens. He wasn't just doing serious drama. He was proving he could anchor mainstream, if quirky, comedy.
But the truly major breakthrough, the one that brought him fully onto the Hollywood A-list, came later that same year with Moonstruck.
Ugh, Moonstruck.
Starring opposite Cher as a hot-tempered, passionate baker named Ronnie Camerari. The film was a massive Oscar-winning hit with both critics and audiences.
The scene where he delivers the line, "I lost my hand, I lost my bride," is just instantly iconic. His performance perfectly matched the film's operatic romantic tone. It earned him his first major accolade, a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actor.
And some critics thought he should have gotten even more for it.
They did. The sources note that in a retrospective review, Roger Ebert felt Cage's performance in Moonstruck was even deserving of an Academy Award.
So by 1988, this early period has established this crucial and contradictory dual track. He is the intensely committed, dramatic actor who will pull his own teeth.
Mm.
And he's the commercially successful, charismatic, yet slightly manic leading man in hits like Moonstruck. We have the foundation built, but the sources show us that foundation is about to be violently shaken by his own developing artistic philosophy.
As we move into the next phase, that commitment to extreme character work, it shifts from intense method acting to something far more unpredictable. The source material refers to a career slump between 89 and 94, mostly due to box office failures. But artistically, this era produced the pure, unhinged genesis of his signature style.
And the perfect, explosive example of that genesis has to be the 1989 black comedy Vampire's Kiss.
Absolutely.
A major flop at the time, but now it's utterly famous for one reason. Cage's extreme, surrealistic, and completely over-the-top performance as a literary agent who believes he's turning into a vampire.
It is the film that truly introduced Cage Rage to the world. It's the performance that gave birth to countless viral internet memes decades later, the screaming alphabet recital.
The cockroach.
The eating of the cockroach. This was the moment he transitioned from simply playing a character to becoming a vehicle for total, unrestrained impulse.
And the critical establishment absolutely hated it at the time. Critic Vincent Canby of the New York Times famously felt the film was dominated and destroyed by Cage's chaotic, self-indulgent performance.
The reaction was visceral, but the sources later reveal that Cage viewed this very film as the moment he broke free from traditional method acting and began developing his own philosophy.
That tension is key. The mainstream saw chaos. Cage saw artistic liberation. And almost immediately after that, he worked with a director who intrinsically understood that chaotic performative style, David Lynch.
Right, in Wild at Heart in 1990.
Cage starred alongside Laura Dern in this deeply strange road trip Southern Gothic thriller. And the sources note he was drawn to the project specifically because his character, Sailor Ripley, allowed him to impersonate Elvis Presley, a lifelong hero in the singing scenes.
Working with Lynch seemed to just validate his impulse-driven style. He also reunited with Lynch and Dern for the even more obscure and avant-garde project, Industrial Symphony No. 1. These collaborations really cemented his position in the niche world of experimental cinema.
But commercially, his path was still pretty unstable. We see action films like Firebirds being critically savaged and compared unfavorably to Top Gun.
And then there was the erotic thriller Zandali in 1991, which ended up going straight to video in the United States. That further cemented that commercial instability.
Yet the mainstream still responded positively when he returned to lighter stuff. In 1992, his kind of goofy everyman turn in the romantic comedy Honeymoon in Vegas earned him his second Golden Globe nomination.
And Roger Ebert, who was consistently a defender of his maximalist style, he argued against critics who found his acting excessive. He said that Cage's inherent high energy worked perfectly for the premise of that film.
So after several more box office misfires in the mid-90s, the source material shows he hit the absolute pinnacle of traditional dramatic success with Leaving Las Vegas in 1995.
Hmm.
This was the role that completely validated his entire commitment to his art, culminating in a massive award sweep.
This was the transition from eccentric artist to undeniable craftsman. Playing the alcoholic screenwriter Ben Sanderson, who decides to drink himself to death in Vegas, it earned him the Academy Award for Best Actor, a Golden Globe, and a Screen Actors Guild Award. A complete sweep.
This moment was huge. It wasn't just Hollywood. He also won major regional critic awards from Boston, Chicago, Dallas, LA, New York. This was a critical consensus that said unequivocally, this man is one of the great dramatic talents of his generation.
And the preparation for this performance carried forward that intense dedication we saw in Birdie, but applied to a psychological vice rather than a physical one.
What do you do?
To authentically portray severe alcoholism, Cage admitted to binge drinking for 2 weeks, and he meticulously studied footage of himself while intoxicated to nail the behavioral tics and the slurring patterns.
That is intense preparation.
Yeah.
But having established himself as this undeniable dramatic artist, he made a sharp, almost stunning pivot into the world of Hollywood action blockbusters. Why did an Oscar winner suddenly jump into big-budget action roles?
This is a critical narrative bridge. In the mid to late 90s, action cinema was realizing that casting respected dramatic actors, not just muscular B-listers, could elevate these otherwise absurd high-concept premises.
Right. It gives it a certain gravitas.
Exactly. Actors like Cage provided a grounded, neurotic energy that made the impossible scenarios feel more real.
Okay, so let's unpack this shift. The rise of the unlikely offbeat action star.
Huh.
Starting with The Rock in 1996. He established this new kind of action hokation, playing Dr. Stanley Goodspeed, an FBI chemical weapons specialist who is completely out of his depth breaking into Alcatraz.
And his opposite action veterans, Sean Connery and Ed Harris.
Right.
The Rock was a colossal success, directed by Michael Bay, and the sources credit it with establishing him as the offbeat action star, the guy who could bring quirky intensity to explosions.
But 1997 was truly his action peak.
Yeah.
A double tunch of commercially successful, high-concept thrillers. Con Air and Face Off.
In Con Air, Jerry Bruckheimer, the film's mega producer, was so impressed by Cage's dramatic range after leaving Las Vegas that he offered him the lead role of Cameron Poe.
The wrongly incarcerated soldier.
Right. Cage accepted, although he initially wanted to play the villain.
Even in these massive blockbusters, critics were already divided on his signature style. Roger Ebert, for example, criticized his choice in Con Air to play the lead as a slow-witted Elvis type.
Ebert felt it was the wrong stylistic choice for the hero. He argued that a less exaggerated, more straightforward lead would have been better for the film's center.
Which highlights that inherent tension. Cage often prioritizes a weird character choice over the narrative demands of the genre.
And then you have Face Off, directed by the maestro John Woo, which required him and John Travolta to play dual roles after a bizarre face transplant scenario. The level of mimicry and technical skill is immense.
Critics really praised both actors for managing that shift with incredible precision, didn't they?
They did. They noted that both Cage and Travolta invested their switched roles with physical subtleties that reflect the other actor's character. For Cage, playing the maniacal villain Castor Troy, pretending to be Sean Archer, and then Sean Archer pretending to be Castor Troy, it required tremendous technical control over his own physical eccentricities.
The sources show that Cage tried to continually balance the action star paycheck with serious, often romantic, drama. He returned to serious fare with the romantic fantasy City of Angels in 98, and later worked with Martin Scorsese on the 1999 paramedic drama Bringing Out the Dead.
And he consistently maintained that high level of preparation, even at the peak of his commercial fame. For the 2001 war film, Captain Corelli's Mandolin, he committed to learning to play the mandolin completely from scratch.
So the underlying artistic dedication never truly wavered.
No. But his final huge critical moment in this specific era came in 2002 with Adaptation. This was maybe the ultimate meta role, where he played the real-life screenwriter Charlie Kaufman and Kaufman's fictional, more commercially successful twin brother, Donald.
A brilliant dual performance. It earned him his second Academy Award nomination.
Playing Charlie Kaufman, the anxious, self-doubting genius, contrasted perfectly with playing Donald, the relaxed, commercially astute hack. It's an acting high-wire act that forces you to confront the two sides of Cage's own persona, the critically lauded artist and the commercially successful populist.
While this stretch cemented his acting prowess, it also saw his early foray into directing and producing. His production company, Saturn Films, produced critically successful films like Shadow of the Vampire in 2000.
But his directorial debut, the 2002 low-budget drama Sonny, starring James Franco, was a commercial and critical failure. It received poor reviews, and it really demonstrated that while his acting process was unique, his ability to manage a film production was less secure.
This brings us to the core analytical challenge of this deep dive, understanding the philosophy that drives Nicolas Cage and how that philosophy created the spectacular real-life consequences that defined his next decade.
Right.
So let's start with the style he developed, Nouveau Shamanic.
Okay, Nouveau Shamanic. It sounds esoteric, but the sources treat it as a genuine, calculated artistic method. It's a style Cage developed specifically to achieve a state of acting where he feels like he is truly being the character rather than merely acting.
So it's about authenticity through total artistic liberation.
Exactly. He defined it as increasing one's imagination without restraint, specifically to avoid experiencing the sense of being ingenuous or fake.
So it's essentially taking the control and preparation of method acting, the teeth pulling, the binge drinking, and removing the artistic safety net, just letting raw impulse dictate the performance.
That's it, he said. The process itself is about how do you augment your imagination in a healthy way so that you can believe you're these characters? You don't feel like you're acting, you feel like you're being.
And he links this transition directly to Vampire's Kiss.
He does, that famous chaotic scene where he wildly recites the alphabet to his psychiatrist was the result of acting out of impulse dictated by this new liberated style.
What's fascinating, and a key insight from the source material, is how the real excessive world bled directly into this artistic process. We see these bizarre real-life influences on his performances, like his pet cobras.
It sounds absurd, but it's true. He was inspired by his pet cobras, which he owned at the time. They would try to hypnotize him by moving side to side. So Cage adapted this specific movement for his character's attack sequences in Ghost Rider, Spirit of Vengeance. The physical manifestation of his character literally came from studying the hypnotic aggression of his exotic pets.
This philosophy demands that the artist constantly seek new, intense, and often bizarre sensory input to feed the imagination. It necessitates a life lived at maximum volume where experience trumps restraint.
That's the crucial analytic connection we have to draw. The industry response to this self-created maximalist style is naturally split, reflecting that tension between performance and restraint.
On one hand, you have high praise. David Lynch called him the jazz musician of American acting, acknowledging the improvisational, high-energy nature of his craft.
And Ethan Hawke went even further, claiming Cage was the only actor since Marlon Brando that's actually done anything new with the art.
That is enormous praise, placing him in the pantheon of cinematic innovators.
Yeah.
But then you have the countervailing force, the critics who just labeled his work overacting.
And he leaned into that label. He described his intentional, fully unleashed performances as mega acting. And there were notable figures like Sean Penn back in 1999 who said Cage was no longer an actor but more like a performer.
So Penn was suggesting a prioritization of charisma and spectacle over deep, nuanced character study during that action peak.
For a while, perhaps. But the critical dialogue has shifted. Even Penn walked back his comments slightly, later citing Cage's performance in Matchstick Men as one of the best of 2003. And now, throughout the 2010s and 2020s, a growing number of critics describe him as one of the most underrated actors of his generation.
The consensus is shifting to appreciate the unique, sustained nature of his commitment. But the trouble is that this philosophy of imagination without restraint, this demand for total, maximum experience, seems to have completely transcended his art and invaded his personal finances in spectacular, catastrophic fashion. We have to now plunge into the financial abyss.
The sources indicate the financial drama began right at the height of his income. In 2009, Forbes reported he earned a staggering $40 million.
$40 million in 1 year.
That money, rather than being managed conservatively, fueled an extraordinary, almost fictional spending spree.
And the spending spree, based on the list of purchases, it reads exactly like a physical manifestation of nouveau shamanic philosophy. Acquisition of the most unique, eccentric, and expensive items simply because his imagination demanded them.
That's the key analytical point. His real estate portfolio reads like the itinerary for a monarch. We're talking about a property on Paradise Island in the Bahamas, a 40-acre private island in the Exuma Archipelago.
And then European historical landmarks. He bought the medieval German castle Schloss Neidstein in 2006, sold it 3 years later. He purchased Midford Castle in Somerset, England, and Grey Craig, a massive 24,000-square-foot country manor in Rhode Island.
These aren't just houses. They are historical power fantasies.
And perhaps the most infamous purchase, perfectly symbolizing his gravitation toward chaotic energy, was the LaLaurie Mansion in New Orleans.
Oh, yes. Notoriously referred to as the most haunted house in America due to its dark history, he bought it and, of course, later lost it.
The reckoning came swiftly. In 2009, the IRS filed a federal tax lien against him for over $6.2 million in unpaid federal income tax for 2007 alone.
And he was also facing another lien for over $350,000 dating back to 2002-2004. This single event, this massive $6.2 million hole, is the mechanism that forced him into the high-volume, low-quality film production of the 2010s.
So that's the direct cause.
The need to rapidly generate income to service that specific massive debt load immediately forced him onto the treadmill of accepting almost every film role offered, regardless of the script quality. It's a direct link.
In response, Cage immediately launched a $20 million lawsuit against his business manager, Samuel J. Levin, alleging negligence and fraud, claiming Levin put him into speculative and risky real estate investments. He argued he was the victim of poor counsel.
But what makes this entire episode so narratively compelling is Levin's counterclaim. The manager denied negligence, alleging instead that Cage simply ignored repeated, explicit warnings about living far beyond his means. Levin basically framed Cage as an unmanageable spender.
And Levin provided the receipts. The manager's filing details the sheer volume of his extravagant shopping spree, which is frankly unbelievable. The document listed Cage's acquisition of 15 personal residences.
15.
22 automobiles, including 9 Rolls Royces, a flotilla of yachts, and 47 separate purchases of exotic items.
Levin also claimed he specifically advised Cage against buying a Gulfstream jet. This excessive spending on esoteric or antique items created constant, unserviceable cash flow issues. But the most bizarre exotic item, the one that truly defines the extravagance, was the stolen Tarbosaurus skull.
Wait, pause on that. A dinosaur skull?
Yes. In 2007, Cage purchased a 67-million-year-old Tarbosaurus Batar skull at auction for $276,000. He actually outbid Leonardo DiCaprio for it.
Of course he did.
A purchase rooted in pure, unrestrained impulse. However, years later, the skull was identified as having been illegally poached and smuggled out of Mongolia. Cage, upon discovering its illicit origins, was forced to return it to Mongolian authorities in 2015.
That is the ultimate symbol of the chaos. Acquiring artifacts of profound, ancient significance, only to discover they were bought in a chaotic, legally questionable manner. It mirrors the high-risk approach he took to his acting style.
The financial fallout was devastating. Foreclosures and auction sales became common. The LaLaurie Mansion and his other New Orleans property were sold at auction in 2009 for $5.5 million. His Bel Air home, which had 6 outstanding loans totaling $18 million, was later sold for $10.5 million.
To address the debts that demanded immediate cash, he had to sacrifice some of his most cherished possessions. This included selling one of the rarest comic books in the world, his recovered copy of Action Comics No. 1.
The first appearance of Superman, he sold it in 2011 for a record-breaking $2.16 million.
The sale of that comic, which had immense personal value to him, symbolized the end of the party and the beginning of the debt grind. The cycle of taking on every role imaginable to pay the piper dominated the next decade of his career.
But by 2022, the source material notes that Cage confirmed he had finally paid off his debts and intended to be more selective about his film roles again. A massive chapter of chaotic financial consequence was finally closed.
And that financial clarity seems to have directly enabled a major critical resurgence starting around 2018. Having shed the debt load that forced him into those low-budget direct-to-video features, he was finally free to choose roles that truly leveraged his unique manic genius.
This new era is marked by extraordinary genre-bending performances that feel like the purest expression of nouveau shamanic philosophy, now channeled by choice, not by financial necessity.
You're thinking of Mandy in 2018.
Exactly. The psychedelic horror film, which garnered immense praise for its visually extreme performance.
Then we have 2021's Pig, which was perhaps the most surprising critical success. His performance as a reclusive truffle forager, whose pig is stolen, was restrained yet deeply affecting. It earned him a Critics' Choice nomination and showed he could wield his intensity with profound subtlety.
That leads directly to the meta-commentary phase, the unbearable weight of massive talent in 2022. He essentially played Nick Cage, a highly fictionalized version of himself grappling with fame, mounting debt, and his own bizarre legacy.
A massive success, both critically and commercially. Felt like an unofficial career therapy session.
And most recently, 2023's Dream Scenario, where he played a mild-mannered professor who starts mysteriously appearing in everyone's dreams, earned him his 5th Golden Globe nomination. He is fully and deservedly back at the center of the critical conversation.
His resurgence also coincided with the resolution of his long, strange history with the Superman character.
Yeah, yeah.
He had voiced Clark Kent's Superman in the animated Teen Titans Go to the movies in 2018. Which was, of course, a huge nod to the notorious canceled 1990s Tim Burton film Superman Lives, where Cage was originally supposed to play the Man of Steel.
And he did finally get his live-action Superman cameo in The Flash in 2023 as an alternate version of the hero. But even that was wrapped in a little bit of controversy.
By illustrating his frustration when his artistic intent clashed with corporate production methods.
It was. Cage filmed the scene using volumetric capture, with CGI later used to de-age him and render the final scene. However, Cage later commented publicly that the final cameo, due to the post-production rendering, looked nothing like what he actually filmed.
He felt they used a digital approximation of him rather than the performance he delivered.
He lamented that the performance, the essence of the character, was missed by the high-budget apparatus.
Looking ahead, his slate is incredibly diverse. He confirmed to play the legendary football coach and broadcaster John Madden in an upcoming Amazon MGM Studios film.
And he's returning yet again to the superhero realm. He's set to star as the live-action title role in the Spider-Noir series for Amazon, which is set in 1930s New York City. Filming for that began in September 2024. His career has never been more eclectic or critically promising.
Turning to his personal life, the theme of chaos and rapid change continues, mirroring the unpredictability of his career trajectory, especially in his romantic history. He has been married 5 times.
Indeed. His first marriage was to Patricia Arquette from 1995 to 2001. His second was to Lisa Marie Presley, daughter of Elvis, whom Cage famously loved and often impersonated.
That marriage was exceptionally short.
Just 107 days from August to November 2002 before they filed for divorce, which was finalized in 2004.
His third marriage was his longest, to Alice Kim, whom he married in 2004 and divorced in 2016, and with whom he shares a son, Kal-El.
Then came the shortest, most dramatic episode. His marriage to Erica Koike in March 2019 in Las Vegas. He filed for annulment only 4 days later.
4 days.
Yeah, claiming he was too intoxicated at the time to understand the nature of his actions. He was granted a divorce 3 months later, ending what was essentially a weekend fling turned legal entanglement.
He seems to have found some stability now, though. His current marriage is to Riko Shibata, whom he married in 2021. They welcomed their daughter, August Francesca, in September 2022.
It's important to note the difficult family dynamics present in the sources, too. Cage has an older son, Weston Coppola Cage, from a relationship with actress Christina Fulton. Tragically, Weston was recently arrested in July 2024 on serious charges of assaulting numerous people with a deadly weapon, including his mother.
It highlights the ongoing personal challenges that exist beneath the public eccentricities. Despite the public perception of financial and personal instability, the sources consistently highlight his impressive charitable endeavors, balancing the chaos with genuine generosity.
He is genuinely one of Hollywood's most generous stars. He donated $2 million to Amnesty International to help provide rehabilitation shelters for over 300,000 child soldiers globally.
He also donated $1 million to the victims of Hurricane Katrina.
And he served as a UN ambassador for global justice in both 2009 and 2013, focusing and raising awareness about arms control and supporting various health and education initiatives.
And then there's the quest for the Holy Grail. This falls firmly under the unrestrained imagination category.
Absolutely. At one point, Cage decided he wanted to develop the philosophical aspect of his nature, and this led him on a literal physical quest for the Holy Grail. He traveled to England and specific rumored locations in the United States in pursuit of this legendary relic. This wasn't a joke. He was seeking a philosophical experience.
That is less of an actor's quirk and more of a Renaissance obsession. It shows how the same drive that led him to buy castles led him to search for mythical artifacts. The financial chaos and the bizarre personal incidents seem to peak around the same time. We have to touch upon the 2011 New Orleans arrest, which became the ultimate pop culture footnote to that era.
In April 2011, he was arrested in the French Quarter on suspicion of domestic abuse battery, disturbing the peace, and public intoxication. Police were flagged down after Cage allegedly grabbed his then-wife's upper arm during a public argument.
And here is the truly unbelievable coda to that already strange incident. Dwayne Dogg, Chapman Dogg, the bounty hunter, posted his $11,000 bail.
Yes. The reality TV star, Dogg the bounty hunter, stepped in to pay the bail. It is the perfect surreal footnote to Cage's debt-ridden, chaotic period. The celebrated, erratic artist needing the help of an orange-tanned reality star to get out of jail.
All charges were ultimately dropped in May 2011, but the image remains indelible. The universe surrounding Nicolas Cage is always stranger and more perfectly cast than fiction.
Yeah.
So if we step back and summarize this entire wild arc, what we've explored is an extraordinary set of contradictions. On one side, you have the celebrated performer, the Oscar, Golden Globes, and SAG Award winner, the one lauded by the most serious critics in America for leaving Las Vegas.
And on the other, you have the chaos magnet, the $6.2 million IRS tax lien, the catastrophic real estate implosion, the exotic collecting, the dinosaur skulls, the 9 Rolls Royces, the search for the Holy Grail, and the 4-day marriage.
His personal life often seemed to function as an off-screen performance, mirroring the most unhinged, impulse-driven characters he delivered on screen.
Which leads us back to our final central analytical thought. We learned that Nicolas Cage's artistic method is nouveau shamanic, requiring him to augment his imagination without restraint to truly be the character.
Right.
This raises a profound question about the border between art and life for him. Did the pursuit of this massive, unbridled, real-life excess-buying castles, islands, exotic skulls, Rolls Royces, did it stem from a deep artistic need for total, unrestrained, lived experience to feed his unique, unconventional acting method?
Or was it simply the highly publicized, inevitable downside of fame, combined with poor financial management, with the philosophy just serving as a convenient artistic justification?
The sources certainly suggest that for Cage, the pursuit of maximum, sometimes absurd, experience was foundational to his identity and necessary for his craft.
And perhaps for the jazz musician of American acting, the performance just never stops, both on and off the camera.
It forces you to wonder if the genius is inseparable from the chaos. How much of the reality of Nicolas Kim Coppola is feeding the uninhibited, maximalist spirit of Nicolas Cage in his current, critically acclaimed roles?
That's it for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.